Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We begin with a subject that is not so easy to swallow, harassment in the workplace. It may take many forms and can be based on sex, race, religion, or other factors. It's objectionable on many levels, but how does the law protect victims and employers? Missouri is said to fall short in workplace harassment policies. We're talking about it today with Jessica Liss, managing principal with the Jackson Lewis Law Firm, a longtime leader in the area of workplace practices. Jessica, nice to have you back with us again.
Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Let's kind of nail down a definition of what we're talking about. What constitutes workplace harassment today?
In short, employers are not permitted to discriminate against their employees or job applicants because they possess certain immutable traits, as you mentioned, race, religion, gender, and other protected traits. Those are protected under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Harassment is a form of discrimination that also would constitute a violation of Title VII. Harassment can relate to those protected traits. Harassment can be based on race or gender. We most commonly associate harassment with sexual harassment, which would be unwelcome verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature that is severe and pervasive and affects working conditions or creates a hostile work environment.
You and your firm come at it primarily from the employer's perspective. I mean, you work with employers primarily. But can't workplace harassment, and we're going to be doing this all during the program with harassment and harassment. Let's just let it go at that.
Okay.
Both are correct, I think. What about other members of the employer's firm? I'm talking about co-workers dealing with harassing other workers. Is that part of the picture as well, or is it simply an employer-worker phenomenon?
Great question. Harassment and discrimination can be perpetuated by coworkers, and it can be perpetuated by supervisors and those in management positions.
Right. What is the most common form of harassment?
That's a difficult question. As I said, coworkers can harass each other. Outside vendors and third parties can also harass employees in the workplace. As a general rule, you see a lot of litigation related to supervisors engaging in harassment or retaliation. And when that occurs, the employer can be held strictly liable for the actions of their supervisors.
How does one know if they are a victim or subject to harassment?
Great question. So harassment is unwelcome conduct that it can be more than one act. It's generally severe and pervasive and may affect your working conditions.
There's a comfort level. I suppose if something makes you feel uncomfortable, then you should begin thinking about it possibly being harassment.
That's right. Regrettably, people are treated unfairly or with disrespect in the workplace every day. That's not necessarily unlawful. However, the real question is, when does the behavior rise to the level of unlawful conduct? And it is the person's individual perception of whether or not the conduct is unwelcome.
What recourse does an employee have?
So when we talk about how to protect against harassment, it's important for the employees to report misconduct.
To whom?
To a supervisor or to those in a management or leadership position. One of the cardinal requisites of employers is to have strict policies in place that prohibit harassment and discrimination. Within those policies, there's an expectation of a grievance process, and the employees should have a clear understanding and roadmap of how to report unprofessional conduct and report harassment.
What does that grievance process typically look like?
So employers are obligated to take reasonable steps to prevent harassment, and they're required to take prompt corrective action when harassment occurs. We want employees to understand who to complain to, how to complain, what the contents of that complaint should be, and to understand that they should not be retaliated against, more importantly, in the event they come forward with a complaint.
So the employer then is obligated to do what? Once the complaint is filed and a grievance has been submitted, what next? What's the next step?
The employer is obligated, both legally and, frankly, it's the right thing to do, to take prompt corrective action, to complete a thorough investigation and to follow through with any corrective action, be it discipline of a harasser or addressing the behavior in the workplace.
Isn't there kind of a fox guarding the hen house quality to this, though?
You could perceive it as the police policing the police. Yeah. And I think we have seen that recently in some of the criticisms directed to the Missouri Department of Corrections. The issues arising out of the Department of Corrections relate to some confusion as to where to report your complaints and how those reports were being handled.
Yeah, we should point out that this situation, a number of instances in which female employees of the Department of Correction were complaining about sexual innuendo and that's and even more than that.
That's right. And yeah. I will say I was not involved in those circumstances, but what you're seeing in terms of testimony in front of the legislation by DOC leadership is an acknowledgement that there was some confusion in terms of how to report and what was going to occur with the complaint after it was reported. And as you mentioned, we learned that in 2016, there have been millions of dollars paid to primarily females who came forward complaining of harassment and retaliation.
And probably cost the director of corrections his job.
Right. Potentially, yes.
Right. The what happens to employers who don't follow through in the prescribed manner? What recourse then does the complaining party have?
It opens up the employer to costly litigation. It opens up the employer to charges of discrimination that will be filed with the EEOC or the Missouri Commission on Human Rights, and then what ensues next is likely litigation. When you're not enforcing policies and maintaining policies to address workplace misconduct.
Is this the point at which the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, comes into the picture?
Yes, that would be
not before.
Yes, so that the EEOC would be the federal agency charged with enforcing Title VII, and complainants would be required to go through the administrative agency first and exhaust their administrative remedies before filing a lawsuit.
I said in the introduction that Missouri, it's felt by many anyway, that Missouri comes up short when it comes to policies concerning workplace harassment. Address that, if you would. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes. Missouri is considered one of the most lax states in this country in which to bring discrimination lawsuits. And we know most recently that the Missouri legislature is attempting to take action to perhaps repair our reputation and review legislation that would recalibrate the standards that one must adhere to before bringing a discrimination lawsuit against an employer.
I have here some language. While we're on this part of the subject, let me just bring this in. This is the anti-discrimination legislation that's being debated right now. It raises the burden of proof with regard to the allegations to prove that race, religion, sex, or age, or another protected status was the motivating factor for an action against them, as opposed to being a contributing factor. Explain the distinction, if you will, between the two.
Absolutely. So this bill is sponsored by Senator Romaine, a Republican out of Farmington. And the interesting issue with respect to this debate is that It has been characterized as a bill intended to change Missouri discrimination laws. In reality, I believe the bill is not changing the Missouri Human Rights Act, but seeking to restore the actual meaning of the existing law within the statute. And what I mean by that is there is a meaningful difference between contributing factor standard and the but-for standard. More specifically, this revision seeks to restore what we call the causation standard. And as you've said it, the current standard is that employment practices are unlawful when the protected trait is a, quote, contributing factor. That is an incredibly low standard, and one which I have to explain to employers every day. And if we look to the original statute and legislative intent, I believe some will agree that it is a but-for or because of causation standards. So this legislation, in my opinion, and I think the opinion of business leaders and academics, is to restore or recalibrate what the legislature intended 50 years ago. And the reason we're in this predicament is because in 2005, jury instructions were adopted that lowered the causation standard to the contributing factor.
It seems to me that it's going to make it harder then for a complaining party to win a case.
That is an opinion of some of the critics. Uh-huh. The interesting thing is that Missouri is one of a very few states that follow contributing factor causation standard. Uh-huh. What this new legislation seeks to do is align causation, recalibrate some of the other issues that we're seeing every day, and make it consistent with federal court. I don't believe that it will have a chilling effect on plaintiffs coming forward with claims. I believe that those claims will continue to be filed and exist. And if discrimination occurred, there will be remedies. And at the same time, if these corrections are made by the legislature, I think it will temper some of the frivolous lawsuits that we are seeing throughout Missouri.
Which is the intent. I mean, the governor and legislators have made it clear that they want to, quote, rein in lawyers stop or at least reduce the number of cases like this. But would the legislation here in Missouri put this state more in line with other states? If we're pretty far down the ladder right now, will it put us in a more equitable position with other states?
First and foremost, it will align the law with what the legislature intended the law to be. It will align us with the rest of the country, and it will align us with federal courts. And another interesting component, an important component, is placing a cap on damages. Those would be consistent with what we see in federal court.
All right. I'm talking with Jessica Liss, who is the managing principal with the Jackson Lewis Law Firm. Our discussion is focusing on workplace harassment. We'll continue the conversation. And if you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, that's okay by us. Do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back to our conversation with Jessica Lynch. Jessica, are more women, do you think, subjected to harassment in the workplace than men? Because men are, and that's probably not widely thought of as being part of the picture.
I would say by and large, women are subjected to sexual harassment. We certainly see claims of sexual harassment asserted by men and against men. Harassment in general, when it's not sex-based, is asserted against, all employees.
part of what you do, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is become involved in training of employers to how to deal with this issue. Give me some sense of what that training is like.
Sure. So it's important not only to lay out your policies and protocols, but to train your employees and supervisors to prevent and report harassment. They should be reporting unprofessional behavior and inappropriate conduct. And when we train, we discuss what harassment looks like. We discuss how to ferret out harassment and that we take all complaints of harassment seriously. And I should say that some employers, I believe, become complacent. They say, we have the policies, we have the training, we're fine. And one nuance is that supervisors and boots on the ground need to be trained at all levels to spot, prevent, and to understand how to discipline inappropriate conduct and harassment, because responses of the supervisor are imputed on the employer. So the acts of your management become the acts or failure to act of the employer.
It would seem to me that it would be very, very hard to spot unless you were on the spot when it was happening.
That's true. You do have to be vigilant and monitor your workplace. And eliminating harassment and discriminatory conduct can include jokes or signs or cartoons. When I train, I ask that if the conduct in question does not propel the mission of the business or the mission of the workplace, then it likely should not be happening.
Yeah. I understand fully, you know, the need and what you're doing with regard to the employers and spotting it and what they have to do to deal with it. But turning to the employees now, I mean, it would seem to me that a little bit of training might be necessary for folks on the receiving end of all of this. Does that happen?
Absolutely. Yeah. Training happens across the entire workforce. It is important to train all employees and all managers so they understand that this is a workplace that doesn't tolerate harassment and discrimination and that it wants to prevent it whenever it's spotted. So it should empower the employee to understand complaints will be taken seriously, they will not be retaliated against, and that they need to come forward and provide the employer with notice. And notice allows an employer to correct bad behavior.
It would also seem to me that this could be used, a complaint could be used as a weapon, if you will, by one employee either using it to attack an employer or to attack a coworker. Does this happen? Is this something that you see?
Unfortunately, complaints can be made based on nefarious motives. Yeah. Notwithstanding, the employer is still obligated to review and investigate, and if the complaint is not substantiated, then or the complaint is deemed to ferret out what you've just described, that it was brought for improper reasons, you can still discipline that employee if that is the conclusion of the investigation.
And what disciplinary action is taken is totally up to the employer, I guess, is to determine to deal with that. We have a tweet here I'd like to read to you and get your response to. Bill writes, "Harassment is completely subjective. The law is watered down, abused, and no longer guided by any logic." Well, that's Bill's thought on the subject.
To some degree, I understand how and why Bill would feel that way. For many years, federal and state law has sought to define what harassment means and why it's protected under Title VII. It can be quite subjective, and it is unwelcome behavior based on the perception of the individual complainant. However, and with that said, it still needs to rise to unlawful conduct. And an employer needs to reach that conclusion based on the totality of the circumstance.
What about the role of witnesses to this sort of thing?
Witnesses are an integral part of substantiating or refuting claims. When we train on how to properly investigate, we talk about who are relevant witnesses, how to obtain important documents, securing technology and data such as emails or video surveillance. All of these things are an important component of an internal workplace investigation.
You just mentioned a couple of things that make me think of a privacy issue. The privacy on the part of an employee, for instance, you're talking about looking at emails and that sort of thing. Do they have to show their emails? Do they have to make them available, that sort of thing?
Generally speaking, if the email or electronic data is being exchanged through a workplace email, that would be under the control and authority of the employer. So they would have the ability to review emails. And again, there should be a policy within any handbook putting the employees on notice that electronic data is available and not necessarily protected from view by the employer.
Let's walk through the process of a complaint. I'm complaining because something has happened in the workplace that I think constitutes harassment. What do I do? What is my first step?
Your first step is to report the behavior to the appropriate supervisor, HR professional, or person in leadership. You want to make sure that the grievance process includes a channel of reporting where you are not obligated to report to the harasser or perhaps a friend of the harasser. Your complaint needs to be acknowledged and reviewed thoroughly. Once the complaint is reviewed, then, as I said, the investigation would ensue to determine whether or not there is ample information to support the complaint. If it is deemed to be true and substantiated and discipline needs to take place against the harasser or other remedial action, then that's what an employer should do, up to and including termination.
And if it is deemed not to be true?
If it is deemed not to be true, everyone is instructed that the complaint was taken seriously. The complainant may be informed of the employer's findings, and everyone is instructed that there shall be no retaliation because the person complained. That's a protected right to do.
That's an issue I wanted to raise because you alluded to it before. That is written in granite, that there is to be no retaliation.
It should be written in granite. It should be written within the policies. We've seen just recently that the EEOC has promulgated guidance on retaliation, and the guidance is very broad. And some would argue that it expands what we're seeing in the court in terms of what amounts to retaliation and what's required to prove retaliation.
You mentioned taking a complaint to HR, human resources, within a company. What if there is no HR department? One of our producers has pointed out that a lot of nonprofits don't have HR offices.
That's true. You should take it to a person in leadership, whether that's the business owner, someone within the C-suite, or in decision-making authority, or frankly, a board if that exists in a not-for-profit or government setting.
What if the person being complained about is the boss?
That is always a challenge, and that is why there needs to be clear policies and direction in terms of who is going to be the investigator, who is going to be the unbiased individual to review the complaint. I've seen that many times where it's either the business owner or the chief of police or the person really at the top of the food chain who's being complained about. And at times, an employer will seek an outside law firm or agency to handle the investigation.
It's got to be especially difficult in a very small operation.
Yes.
Where, just a few people in the office. Was there anything else you want to add about this issue? Is it getting worse, do you think? Do you sense that, given the work that you do, that it's worse than maybe it was a few years ago?
The last few years, I believe we've seen an increase in litigation. We've seen astonishing verdicts. Most recently, there were two verdicts out of Jackson County for $20 million and $10 million for employment discrimination claims. I firmly believe that the pending legislation brought by Senator Roman will seek to correct some of the expansive rights that we're seeing.
Got to stop it right there. All Jessica right. Liss, thanks so much for being with us and talking about this important subject. She's with the Jackson Lewis Law Firm. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.